Hey there, Sports History fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
There's a bunch of things we love to talk about. Family, numbers, and how about a top 10 list? Well, let's put them all together. Let's talk about the top 10 greatest number 30s in NFL history with Jeremy McFarland of the Football is Family. He's coming up right after this. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we're podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with the tunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and we continue our Football by Numbers series in this episode. In this edition, we are bringing the mention of the best NFL players that wore the number 30. And we have a guest today, and he's a good friend of the program, none other than my fellow Sports History Network partner, Jeremy McFarland from the Football is Family podcast. Jeremy McFarland, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Darren, for having me back.
Well, we are sure glad you could join us. And Jeremy, we talked a little bit about your podcast last time, what it's all about and everything. But that name, Football is Family, that is such an interesting name. I love the name of it. But was there a reason for the naming the podcast that?
Yeah, there was a commercial about 4 years ago that when the NFL started the season up, where they played a song by the, I believe it was the Magnificent Nine, or I cannot think of the group's name right off the top of my head, but it was called I'm Going Home. And they had a bunch of people driving in their cars or riding their cars, going to games. And as they were doing that, it basically gave this image of football being family. And, you know, with all the stuff that people do to get ready for the games and the habits they have. And I just thought, you know what? That's what football is all about. It's about tradition. It's about all these things. And, you know, I just thought, well, I wanted people to tell the story. So Football is Family came up in my head, and luckily it stuck.
Yeah. I mean, you really identify that theme time and time again. I mean, I know like your earlier podcasts where you're bringing people from representing, you know, many of the teams. I got to represent the Steelers on one of your programs, but just, you know, I love how you bring that family theme home almost every podcast you do. And it's just a great thing. I love the theme of it.
Well, thank you. It's Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros. That's who it was. I knew I got the name wrong. That's
now I know why you didn't remember the name. That's a pretty complicated name for a singing group there.
Well, for a Southern guy like me, anything more than one or two syllables is a little bit much for me, at least.
I think it's just an age thing, you know, because I feel it.
That too.
Well, we have a tall task tonight. We have the greatest number 30s in NFL history. We have 101 years to choose from, all the people that wore the number 30 that played the game. And where we always start, Jeremy, is we have the Pro Football Hall of Fame sort of gives us a clue of some people that they have identified that's in the hall in Canton, Ohio, that wore the number 30. And tonight, I'm just going to mention their names real quickly. We can come back and talk about them in greater detail here in a minute. But it's Terrell Davis, Ollie Mattson, Bill Willis, Clark Hinkle, and I'm going to probably mess up his last name, Alex Wojciechowicz. I think I got it right there. Hopefully I didn't butcher it.
Wojciechowski.
Okay.
The only reason I know that is on Monsters, Inc. It was Mike Wojciechowski or Mike Wachowski or something like that. And it just kind of goes along with that.
Okay. So I did butcher. I'm not good with those long. There's too many letters in that name.
Wojciechowski, so, or we'll just call him Alex.
Alex W.
Alex W.
Okay. I don't know if you want to start, if we want to start by talking about these fine gentlemen, these five.
Well, this past week, and by the way, I just listened to your to your podcast, being on the history of college football. I listened to that just a little bit ago, and I want to give you a kudos for that. That was a great job. I liked it.
Oh, thank you.
And we'll get to one of those players that you mentioned in a little bit, but I want to get to the first one on my list. And this is a special one for me. My last episode of Football's Family, I talked about my fandom of the Broncos, which nearly ended on April 2009. But from 87 till then, I was just a diehard Broncos fan because that was pretty much the only team that I followed or could follow until the Titans came to Nashville. And one jersey that I still own is the number 30 Terrell Davis jersey. I still have it. I got it for Christmas one year from a member of the church I attended. She knew I was a Broncos fan, and she found it. I don't know how she did it, but she found it. Terrell Davis holds a special place in my heart because, number one, he gave my Broncos two Super Bowls. I don't think they would have won it without him.
No, I don't think they would have.
In fact, I think in Super Bowl 32, he was the MVP. Yes, he was.
Yes.
The next year it was Elway. Davis was the heart and soul of that team. But another reason why I like him a lot is I didn't know what was going on. I was in college in 97, 98, 99, 2000, in that area. And I started getting dizzy spells, Darren. I mean, it was bad. It was bad. I thought I was going to pass out. And I got diagnosed with migraines. And over the years, it's gotten worse. But I was like, you know what? People don't understand what migraines. Well, guess what Terrell Davis had in Super Bowl 32?
Had the migraines.
He had a migraine that caused him to miss most of the second quarter. And he has become an advocate for people with migraines because people look at him and say, you know what? People didn't think this was real. And now because of Terrell Davis, which he's a good guy, a good, solid character guy, for what I understand about it, he is an advocate for that. And I appreciate that part.
Now I don't remember. He had a shortened career. I mean, running backs don't have a long career anyway, but he had 7 years, but four of them were just, he was lights out for his first 4 years. And those last 3 years, he really suffered. I know it was some kind of an injury. Was it the migraine that was?
He got, his knee got just shredded. He was the main, let me talk about this. Terrell Davis is my generation, your generation's Gale Sayers. And this is what, when people are talking in my circle, I listen to, Derrick Henry. Derrick Henry has the same type of stats coming out like Terrell Davis did let me see if I got this right here, Darren. From 95 to 98, listen to the yards here. 1,117, 7 touchdowns. 1,538, 13 touchdowns. 1,750, 15 touchdowns. And the kicker, 2008 with, I believe I have 21 touchdowns.
That's correct.
That is 4 years. And you say, well, he didn't play very long. He didn't. He only had 7,600 yards total, averaged 4.6 yards a carry, which is amazing. But you don't really take into consideration a career like Terrell Davis or Gale Sayers. You don't. You take in, were they dominant for a short period of time? And for 4 years, he was pretty much the GOAT of that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that 7,600 yards, 6,500 of it was in those first 4 years. I mean, that's an unbelievable number. There's not too many people who say, hey, I had 6,500 yards in the NFL in 4 years.
Well, not the people I've been looking up today.
Yeah.
But one of the coolest things he did was after he won the Super Bowl, he appeared on Sesame Street. So I give him that too.
Well, right. Yeah, he was just a tremendous back. And I can remember he was really setting the league on fire for those 4 years and really sort of rejuvenated Mr. Elway a little bit, too, near the end of his career. I think he liked having that. He wasn't the whole offense. He could turn around, hand the ball off at somebody that could really make some plays happen. And that's really what Terrell Davis did in that offense, really opened it up for Elway even.
In the 80s, Elway was a one-man band and made it to three Super Bowls. How many did he win? None. But once they got Terrell Davis, and Shannon Sharp, and Rod Smith, And then they started getting Neil Smith and men like that on the defense. It was lights out for 2 years. They were the best team in the NFL.
Absolutely. They sure were. So, yeah, I think Terrell Davis is, you know, definitely, I think he's an automatic to put on our list of our top 10, I think, right now, because
absolutely
he's that special of a player. Now, let's talk about, we have four other Hall of Famers. Now, how about Ollie Mattson? I know we've talked a little bit with Joe Ziemba. We had a big trade a few weeks ago we talked about on the Pigskin Dispatch. We brought Joe Ziemba on, where Ollie Mattson was traded for, I think it was like 11 players to the Rams.
It was that time frame's Dallas Cowboy, Minnesota Viking type trade.
Right, right. Yeah, it was.
I have here, and I'm trying to, my mind went blank on the years, but 5,173 yards total rushing, which in any generation, that's pretty solid. And I think he was pretty much that team for a few years. I mean, he was pretty much made up that team for a few years with what he could do.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, especially when he was with the Chicago Cardinals.
Yes.
That's why we brought Joe Ziemba, because the first 6 years he was a Chicago Cardinal, got traded to the Rams, played with them for 4 years, and then had some stints, 3 years with Philadelphia and one with Detroit in, at the end of his career. But his most damage in the league was definitely as a Chicago Cardinal. He
that to me, when I look at stats like that, I have it that he played 171 games as a running back. That's a lot of wear and tear, and yet he still was considered worth trading that many people for.
Yeah.
Tells you how good he was.
That's definitely right, and that's back in an era where the passing game wasn't as prevalent as is today. You know, I'm not sure what the percentage right. was, but I'm sure it was a great, you know, probably at least 2/3 of a team's offensive plays was running the ball back then in the late 50s and early 60s. I don't know, have the exact stats on that, but that's I'm sure that's what it was. Yeah, but one thing about Ollie Mattson making our list is he only wore the number 30 for one season. That's in 1963. That's what I have. So, I mean, that doesn't mean he's not on the list, but I can't say I can put him on that list right now with only one season wearing the 30.
Well, I'll tell you what, he can wear whatever he wanted to for me, you know.
Well, how about if we put him as a standby check and we'll come back to him at the end. Maybe we'll come back and you can convince me then. I'm not fully convinced yet. Another great player from almost the same era, who played, well, I guess he played a little bit before Mattson, was Bill Willis, Hall of Famer, three times in a Pro Bowl, three times as an All-Pro, NFL championship, and four-time AAFC champion.
Now, I don't have too many stats for him. I have that he played guard. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Cleveland Browns.
Back when oh, good gracious. Yes, yes. So he would have been blocking for Otto Graham. I thumbs up right there.
Right, right. And I think he missed out on Jim Brown. I don't think Jim Brown was there in 53. That was his last season with the Browns. Where he just maybe Brown might have been his first year, but you know that AAFC run. They won every single championship in the AAFC for the 4 years, and then came in the NFL, lost in a championship game, and I think the next year they won the NFL championship game. So quite a run for the Cleveland Browns.
And this shows you how well the Cleveland Browns adapted to situations when it comes to players. They probably wouldn't. Not too many teams probably gave Bill Willis a chance, but the Browns did, and look what they got. They got a Hall of Famer out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, he.
That to me, when I start, you know, being part of this history network has, you know, I've read a lot before, but now it's opened my eyes to show how people understand it's not the color of skin, it's who you are and what you can do for the team. And when you're in the huddle, it doesn't matter who you are, you're part of that team. And that to me, that's an example that we should look at today more so than ever.
You're absolutely right. You know, there's a interesting thing about the his numbers. Okay. He was number 30 for his first 8 years in the league, or 8 years of pro football. And the last 2 years, he had to change to number 60. And wondering, I know the answer, but do you know why he had to change that number to 60 in 1952?
I will in a second when you tell me.
That was when the AFC had a different numbering system in the NFL. So they merged the three teams from the AFC, which were the Browns, the 49ers, and the Colts. They brought them in the NFL. They were still allowed to wear their old number. So, you know, as a guard, you had Mr. Willis wearing number 30, but became kind of confusing. So the NFL, right before the 1952 season, put their numbering requirements that are sort of the precedent of what we have today, where the interior linemen have to wear a 50 through 79, and, you know, backs have to wear certain numbers. You know, I think it's the 20s to the 40s. Wide receivers back then had to wear 80s. Since then, you know, just a few years ago, they opened it up so they could wear some of the teens and the lower numbers. But that's when that rule really came into effect for interior linemen, had to wear 50 through 79.
That would have been weird to see an offensive lineman with a 30 on.
Yeah, I think so. And that's what they said there. I was reading about it. There's a lot of confusion for the previous NFL teams, because they, you know, they really didn't know, you know, guy wearing number 30, you don't know if he's going to go out for a pass, or, you know, so there's some pass eligibility rules there with the numbers that are helpful. I know, as now, an official, it's real helpful.
Now I'm looking at his size. They had him listed at 6'2", 213 pounds, which would have been today would have been a safety or a cornerback.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, how the Browns ran their offense is a lot of pulling. So having an offensive guard that size might not have been a bad thing.
Yeah, maybe probably wasn't, but probably he was probably pretty tall for a guard back then, you know, 6'2". You know, I'm sure your quarterbacks weren't the size they are today. So, you know, the passing game, Otto Graham, I'm not sure how tall he was, but I wonder if that was a problem for him ever looking over, you know, somebody 6'2" in front of him.
Well, just talk to Drew Brees. I'm sure it's now Otto Graham was 6'1".
Oh, was he? Okay.
He wasn't. According to Pro Football Reference, which is a great website, by the way.
Absolutely is. I get a lot of my stats from there. So,
but
okay.
Now Bill Willis deserves to be on that list because of just the fact that he is the man.
I agree with you. And he had that number 30 for six seasons. So
absolutely. So what do we got? We got Terrell Davis as a must.
Terrell Davis and Willis are on our list for sure.
All right.
We have Ollie Mattson as a comeback to guy. Okay. Might as well stay on the Hall of Famers. How about Clark Hinkle?
Let me see if I could figure out where I put him on this paper. And I can't read my writing, so you might want to go ahead and
give you a little bit of background on him. He was a two-way player, played for the Green Bay Packers his entire career, 1932 to 1941. So back in that era of a single platoon, he played fullback, linebacker, halfback, defensive back. So he's a Mr. Everything then. So as a running back, he had 3,860 yards, 3.3 yards per carry average, 35 touchdowns. Not too shabby.
No, not at all.
I don't have I don't have any of his defensive stats because they really didn't keep track of him back in those days. But, you know, everything I've read about him, he was a pretty fearsome opponent to go up against because he was a good tackler. And
that is when, if I remember correctly, Don Hutson would have been around that same time. So having that type of rushing yards with a receiver like Don Hutson is pretty impressive.
Right.
So I'll tell you what. And the Packers of the 30s and 40s were not too shabby either.
No, I mean, you had Curly Lambeau as your coach. I think he might have been a player coach at that point in time too. And they were the smallest team in the whole NFL, which I think they are now too, the smallest market. But it was even more effective back then because, you know, you didn't have the funds spread out across the league. Each team was sort of their own funding and what players they could get. That's why Chicago and New York dominated so much. But Clark Hinkle, definitely a good player. Wore that number for a few seasons too. for nine seasons, number 30. So I'm going to say, you know, probably just what I read about him. We don't have a lot of stats on him, but I think he probably deserves to go on that list too.
Well, when we take into consideration the time he played with the touchdowns, he said he has 35 rushing touchdowns and nine receiving. So that's pretty solid.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So I'm
all right. I can see him in there.
Okay. So we have three spots of our 10 taken.
And we're going to be a lot of defensive backs and running back heavy on this number.
Oh yeah, that's a big number for that. But before we get to that, we have one more Hall of Famer, and he's another lineman, another two-way player, and that's our famous Alex W, which I don't want to butcher his name again, but you know, Alex is another great player. Detroit Lions for most of his career, 9 years with the Lions, five with the Philadelphia Eagles near the end of his career, played from 1938 to 1950 in that era. So,
now, what gets me about this is they have him listed with 19 interceptions. Considering the 38 to 50 with passing is not as prevalent as it is now, that is really, really good.
From a linebacker on defense, too.
That's absolutely. That's really, I would love to see, of course, I don't think they have the stats, but I would love to see how they break it down now for the defensive backs back then. You know, the how many times they have been, you know, targeted and how many passes defended. Because, you know, if you think about it, 19 interceptions, you know, well, that's not much now, but then that could have led the league. Who knows, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, 1 year, 1944 for Detroit, he had seven interceptions at the linebacker position. That had to lead linebackers of today. You know, I mean, how many linebackers have seven interceptions in a season, in a, you know, 16 game season?
He is listed at 5'11", 217 pounds. So that I would consider that rangy.
Yeah,
he had the ability to go inside, go outside. That's impressive too. I tell you what, I'm loving seeing these older players come up on our list and to see how they adapted to the game that they had.
Right, right. You know, you sit there and you think about all the interceptions. If you look at those Detroit teams from the 40s and 50s and the players that were on them, you know, Dick LeBeau, Night Train Lane, and there's a couple other defensive backs I'm forgetting about. I mean, the amount of interceptions that secondary had for Detroit back then, in an era where they didn't pass that much, it's unbelievable. You know, that had to be kind of scary for quarterbacks.
Well, that had to deal with Alex Karras, and I bet you they were trying to get the ball out pretty fast.
Probably.
Now, I want to tell you a story about I had the chance a few years ago when I lived down in Alabama to call in to the Alabama show, the post-game show after another Alabama Crimson Tide win. And I had the chance to talk to Kenny Stabler.
Wow.
And, you know, I was like, Kenny Stabler and I are just buddies, right? No, I had the chance. And I asked him, I said, Mr. Taylor, can you tell me, if you were to go back in time when you were playing college, can your team play in modern time? And he said, no, I was about 180 pounds and I would be cut in half by some of these linemen that come up at 350 pounds. He said, we wouldn't do it. Some of these players that I'm looking at, like a Bill Willis, probably could play in modern time, but he wouldn't play guard.
Right.
They would have him. They would probably have him as an outside linebacker or a safety. Could Wojciechowski, and again, if I butcher, could he play now? I don't know. I would love to see. I would love to see how modern day games would and the games back then go. See if they go hand in hand. I would love to see that.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say because. Now, I mean, I don't think it was so much back then. You had a lot of players back then were, you know, three sport athletes. You know, a lot of them, you know, they played the baseball, basketball, football. Some played ice hockey. But now it's almost like a specialized thing. When you sort of are a freshman in high school, you're sort of It's rare to have multi-sport athletes, I think, in this day and age, as it was as prevalent as it was before. So you have, football players now, they're training for football all year long. They're eating towards, and their nutrition's towards football, whatever position they are. You know, if you're a lineman, you're eating a lot of carbs, you're lifting a lot of weights, a lot of protein, and you're trying to gain weight to be a football player now. And I don't think that was the case. The sciences and the dietary gurus weren't around then as we have now, and I think that's a big advantage for athletes today.
Absolutely it is.
So Alex would have, if he would have had the same training we have now, he might have been a bigger person playing that position. Who knows?
He's a two-time champion. That's not too shabby either.
No. So what do you think? Should he be on the list, or do you want to come back to him?
I tell you what, we just have to see his name on the back of a jersey. That's all I want to see is his name on the back of a jersey. He could be the ball boy for all I care, but he has to be there on the field just to see his name on the jersey.
Okay.
And just to hear Joe Buck or Troy Aikman try to pronounce his name.
I hear you. Well, how about we put him as a standby? Because he wore the number for three seasons. Let's make sure we don't have somebody else we wore it for a longer period of time that were more significant as a number 30.
I could do that.
But we'll come back to him just like we will with Ollie Mattson. So that is our five Hall of Famers. We put three of them on the top 10 list already. And like you said, we have a lot of DBs and a lot of running backs to talk about, be under consideration. And I'll let you start where you want to go with our next.
Well, I've got two right off the top of my head that I want to do. And one of them in particular, I alluded to it earlier. I don't think he is going to be on our list, but he deserves an honorable mention. He will be the coin flipper of the game that we're going to play with him. And that's James Conner.
Okay.
And the reason why he is out there is, number one, he's a monster. He's awesome, number one. And I'm saying that because even though he's a Steeler, he's an inspiration because he's a cancer survivor. Yeah, and I don't care how or what team you play on, that to me is very impressive, and I have a great deal of respect for that.
Well, I'm a big fan of his because – he came from Erie, Pennsylvania, where I live. As a matter of fact, he came from the school district that I live in. He was a McDowell Trojan here in Erie, Pennsylvania. I officiated his games through his whole high school and below. So I'm very aware of Mr. Conner, and played right down the road in Pittsburgh, at Pitt University, and as a Steeler for his first four seasons in the NFL. And I'm kind of sad that he might not be back this year with the Steelers.
But this salary cap has gotten everybody upset.
Yeah. But he does. He just has an excellent story. I can remember he was a good player. I was a referee, so I was always in the offensive backfield. And you get to talk to the players a little bit, especially the skilled players, the running backs, the quarterbacks a little bit, when there's timeouts or something going on before the game. And he was always such a polite kid. He was a big kid, back then. He towered above all his teammates and opponents. But he was just a powerful back, the thumper. They had a 1-2 punch at McDowell when he was a senior. And great person. I enjoyed the few times I spoke with him. I remember him, but he was a great person as well as a good football player.
Well, see, when I heard you on the podcast today, I was like, we're going to be mentioning him tonight. So that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But he is definitely going to be out there. He is our inspirational leader.
I agree. I'm not sure he makes the list, like you say, but maybe someday he will, because he's still got a lot of play left in him.
Well, the running backs are devalued. He is a guy that could start on any team to me other than the Titans. He just can't start for the Titans, but not because he's not a good guy, just because we have the best in the league. So I'm just saying. But I do have one that I want to bring up. And okay. One that I think is borderline Hall of Fame.
All right.
And that is Amon Green.
Oh, absolutely.
And I remember watching him play, and I was very impressed. In 148 games, 9,205 yards and 60 touchdowns. Now, again, I say borderline. Will he ever make it? Probably not. But that's a guy there that if I remember watching him as many times as I've seen the Packers play, he was always a guy that would get into little holes and then burst out and go for it. Amon Green is one of my favorite players to watch.
You know, when I was doing the research and I saw his name on there, you know, I looked at his numbers. His numbers kind of surprised me. I didn't realize he had, you know, 9,200 yards rushing and 60 touchdowns. He was just sort of, I mean, I remember hearing his name quite a bit. It's not like I got to watch every Packers game where I live, but I watched, you know, enough of them. But I just didn't realize he had that many yards. I mean, that's pretty significant.
And he played a long time too. He you know, that's they have him listed as 148 games and carries over 2,000 carries in his career. So that's a lot of pounding, and he did all right. He pulled out. I remember him playing for the Seahawks, but the big thing is when he came on to the Packers and trying to see, I don't think he won a Super Bowl with them, but he made the Pro Bowl four times as a running back for the Packers. And that's when they had Favre throwing the ball all over the place. So there you go.
Right. Yeah. He really, really surprised me with his numbers on there. I didn't expect that, but you know, he's definitely, I think he's one of the top 10. I think I would put him on the list right now.
Oh, I would too.
Yards. There's nobody else that has that much yardage as a running back position. Not to be a spoiler.
I would too. He would be number four on that list. If we're going to go with it.
Yep. I think he's our number four on that list.
All right.
Okay. Who else would you like to talk about? Or you want me to take one?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. This is your show. I'm just all taking right. it over.
Okay. Well, I'd like to talk about Lawrence McCutcheon because he's an interesting, another interesting running back. He had 6,578 yards, 26 touchdowns. He played from 1972 to 1981. Eight of those years was with the Rams. That's who he came in the league with. And then he had one-year stints with Buffalo, Denver, and Seattle. But I can remember McCutcheon being pretty significant, and he had four seasons over 1,000 yards, another one where he was 900 yards. He was a five-time Pro Bowler, and he wore that number 30 for nine seasons. So, I mean, I think he was pretty significant as running backs go. Only 6,500 yards, but a 4.3 yards per carry. That's nothing to shake a stick at.
4.3 yards. If you think about that, if you average that in a year, there's you a first down.
Right.
Every three plays.
Right.
You're getting hit as soon as you leave the offensive line. You're getting hit by the defense four or five times. 4.3 yards is great.
Especially when you're a multi-year 1,000-yard rusher, you know, back in that era, you know, you had to have defenses watching you. You know that he's going to get the ball, and you take a pounding, and you still get that 4.3 yard average. That's pretty good.
Yes, it is.
So I'm not convinced that he's on that list yet, but I just wanted to mention him because I think he is definitely significant.
Oh, I agree. 26 touchdowns in that time frame too, when they started to open up the offense with throwing, and the Rams were a throwing team at times. Believe if I look at it correctly, he played in a Super Bowl against the Steelers. Was he a part of that Rams team?
I believe Vince Ferragamo. I believe so. I believe he was on that.
1979.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just like saying that name, Vince Ferragamo.
Yeah.
Sounds like an action hero.
That was quite. Do you remember that Super Bowl? That was quite the buildup for a Super Bowl. I remember.
I was born in 79. I don't have any memories of that, and I'm kind of glad I don't.
Well, they built it up because the Steelers had already won three Super Bowls in the last 5 years prior, or 6 years prior, I think it was, and they built it up of Tinsel Town versus the Steel Town. That was what all the papers were writing before that Super Bowl, the weeks building up to it. So it's kind of an interesting.
Tinseltown versus Steeltown.
Yeah, so it was interesting. It was a good Super Bowl, too, because actually the Rams were leading they came back and were winning that game in the fourth quarter, and the Steelers had to put on a little bit of a offensive show at the end to pull away from the Rams, get the lead back and pull away. So Ferragamo played well. Now, I think another player I'd like to bring up, though, for number 30s is Bill Brown, another running back.
Boom Boom Brown. Now, you remember He Hate Me? I think his name was Rod Smart from the XFL.
Is that who did the He Hate Me?
I want to say it is, and if I'm wrong, you know, you can just give – you can send Darren the comments. But he put He Hate Me on the back of his jersey. If we pick Bill Brown, he cannot use Brown. He has to use Boom Boom on the back of his jersey.
Okay. That's, all right. But, yeah, Boom Boom came in the league 1961 with the Bears and then played the rest of his career, which ended up being 14 seasons total. 13 of those were with the Minnesota Vikings, and a real nice career he had. 5,838 yards, 52 touchdowns, 3.5 yards per carry. Not a bad career.
Well, you're talking about the 60s, the 70s Minnesota Vikings. That's Super Bowl era. Yeah. Yeah, I tell you what. I guess the Bears didn't need another running back. They were going to get a good one pretty soon.
Right.
I'm looking here. He had in 1 year, let's see, he rushed 251 times, and that led the league in 1966.
Right.
You know, Boom Boom probably, he might deserve to be looked at.
Yeah, he's interesting. And he was listed as a fullback for most of his career. Now, back in that era, you know, Franco Harris was also a fullback, but they, a few years later, but the fullbacks carry the ball a lot more than they do today. They aren't just that blocking back. Sometimes fullbacks were the bell cow. And I think Boom Boom might have been the bell cow for some of his seasons.
But I'd say let's give him a second look.
Okay. We'll put him on our list to come back to. Okay, why don't you go ahead and go next?
Well, let's go deep into that list that you sent me, because I think if I looked at it correctly, there was one. Oh, yep. Brian Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
This is way down the list.
Right.
But, you know, everybody knows Dante Hall. And my mind went blank. Number 23, I just listened to yours. Devin Hester.
Right.
Everybody knows them. But the fact is, they wouldn't have been who they were if it wasn't for the fact that Brian Mitchell was there first. Mitchell was listed as he played part running back, part receiver. But the fact is, he was a kick return and punt return master. What I have right here, 463 punt return for 4,599 yards and 9 touchdowns. But the kick return is what gets me there. And this right here, if you want to see how you win games, you flip the field. 607 kick return for 14,014 yards, 4 touchdowns with a 101 long return.
Yeah.
That is how you flip a field.
Absolutely. I mean, just think about those averages you just said. If my math is right, he averaged over 10 yards a punt return and over 20 yards per kick return.
I mean, now, punt returning is hard.
Absolutely.
Because they're getting a running start at you. You're not going to get too many broken tackles. You're just not. But that kick return, if you get the ball at the 10-yard line or 15-yard line, you're almost halfway you're almost to the 50. With 20 yards, that helps an offensive out. And I have it here listed that he won a Super Bowl, and I believe he was with the Redskins.
I believe that was the case. I think you're right.
Brian Mitchell, to me, Brian Rip Mitchell is one of the best return of all time. He is on. If you have a Mount Rushmore, he is on there.
I think I don't disagree with you. He was a outstanding back, and he was like that, you know, very dangerous on third downs and the offensive side too. you know, because he was a dual threat. He could run pretty well, and he could catch passes out of the backfield fairly well, too. His yardage rushing was just under 2,000 yards, but he wasn't, a feature back by any means. He wasn't a three-down back. But his receiving, 255 receptions for over 2,300 yards receiving in his career, in total of 16 touchdowns, 12 rushing, 4 from the pass. So good, solid back all around and a good returner.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think he's definitely worth a consideration too. So we'll have to come back and check out him too, I think.
All right.
Who else do you have?
No, I'll flip it to you.
Okay. Why don't we stay with some running backs? Cause there's still, I still have a couple significant ones. How about Mark Van Egan? Probably a little bit before your time, but I can remember him. He was just a mean running back for the Oakland Raiders in the '70s. That's sort of one of those rivalries that my Steelers had to go against almost every year. It seemed like it was the Oakland Raiders. And Van Egan was just had that Raiders moniker about him. He's just a tough bad guy. Everybody, the rest of the league looked at him as a bad guy, and the Raiders just loved that to personify that. But he had 6,651 yards rushing in his career, 37 touchdowns in 136 games. Played from 74 through 1981 with the Raiders, and then had a couple years with New England at the end of his career, 82 and 83. But, solid back, real tough back. 4 yards per carry was his average on that. So, again, not a bad mark there for a running back.
We look at it's hard to hold a candle to what Walter Payton, Barry Sanders, and Emmitt Smith did. But in an NFL career, 6,600 yards is pretty solid.
Right. Yeah, especially you had a pretty good passing attack. You mentioned Kenny Stabler. He was a quarterback for much of that. You had Fred Biletnikoff, another guy from Erie, Pennsylvania, played on those teams. Cliff Branch, Dave Casper at tight end. The Raiders had some good offensive weapons in that era when Van Egan played. So he did not have to produce a lot. He was just sort of a guy that carried the ball when they needed him to.
Fred Biletnikoff, every time I think of him, I think of the scene from the NFL films where somebody has to put gum in his mouth because he has stickum all over his hand. Every time I think of Fred Biletnikoff, I think of that scene.
Oh, yeah. The Raiders, they must have went through a lot of jars of stickum when that was legal, because Lester Hayes and those guys. I can remember that was a big thing when I was playing probably fifth and sixth grade football. That's when the stickum was real big, and we were allowed to use it then. So we'd have stickum, you'd always put a little swab of stickum on the back of your helmet just because the pros did it, of course. It's all like, fifth and sixth grade, we're not throwing a lot of passes out there, but hey, you did it. I was a running back, so I had a stickum on my hands. It was terrible. It's a terrible thing. It's like having super glue on your hand almost. Especially on a grass field, as soon as you get tackled, you get up, it looks like you're the straw man, your hands all full of dead grass, but not a pleasant thing. But hey, it was a part of football, and it was kind of an interesting, fun thing to think about.
It's a different time.
Yeah. A couple other running backs, which I'm not sure if even I'm not even sure if Van Egan will have consideration. But these other two running backs definitely probably won't, because Van Egan's a little bit more substantial than them. But Ron Johnson is one of them I like to talk about. He ended up having 4,300 yards, 40 touchdowns, played from 1969 to 1975. So only 7-year career, came in with Cleveland for a year and then played 6 years with the Giants. But still, in 7 years to have 40 touchdowns, that's not too bad.
No, it isn't.
So I thought about mentioning him. And the other one is Mike Rozier. Great player from Nebraska, had a great college career. He had ended up in the NFL, had 4,462 yards, 30 touchdowns. And I don't think they count him when he played for, I think it was the USFL.
I was actually listening to America's Game by Mike. I cannot think of his name. But I was listening to that today, and they mentioned the USFL. And I was thinking, was that the same Mike Rozier that was on that that played for the USFL? But yes, it is.
Yes.
Yeah. No, they wouldn't have counted that, even though they consider the pros as he was in the pros. Mike McCambridge, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm having issues today. But they mentioned the USFL, and I think he won the Heisman, didn't he?
I think you might be right. I think he did win the Heisman with Nebraska.
I want to say that the USFL got Herschel, got Doug Flutie, and they got Mike Rozier. And I think they pretty much scalped all the
Jim Kelly
Heisman Trophy winners about 3 years in a row.
Yeah, right. But, you know, Jim Kelly and some other great players too that didn't win Heismans that were great college players. But I wonder why that is, that the Pro Football Hall of Fame, they call themselves that purposely so that they can include AFL statistics, AAFC statistics, but they don't include them for the USFL, and I don't think they do for the WFL, the World Football League, either. Maybe because they only were a couple seasons old.
Well, Steve Young would have had a lot better numbers if his numbers were included from the USFL.
All right. I guess another back to talk about, and he's still playing, is Todd Gurley. Todd has actually more yardage than I thought he did as a pro. He has had almost 6,100 yards of rushing the ball, 67 touchdowns for Mr. Gurley. And he's only been in the league for 6 years. So
he has for such a young guy, I think his biggest problem was he has arthritis buildup in his knees or his ankles. I'm going to say it's his knees. And my youngest, she's 7 years old. She has juvenile arthritis right now. And we're dealing with that. Watching her, she has to take a couple shots a week. Watching her deal with her arthritis, I can't imagine, you know, she's just going about riding at school. You're getting tackled. And you're running and you're cutting. I can't imagine what that's like to have arthritis in your knees and having to do that.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize he had that in his knees. I know he's had some leg problems. Like, what do you do, a tear an ACL his senior year in college?
Yes. I remember watching that game. He was predicted to go pretty high, and he did. But I think his draft stock went down as a result of that.
Yeah, he could have been a Heisman winner, I think, that year. That's how good he was. And that was a pretty devastating injury to him. But I'm glad he came back and he's playing at a high level in the pros, though. So that's a good thing. I think last year he was with Atlanta, had 5 years with the Rams, 1 year in St. Louis and 4 in L.A. So
I like Todd Gurley. Is he one of our top 10? You know, he probably will end up with more yards than Terrell Davis. You know, there's a good chance that he could. But who meant more to their team?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, Todd Gurley playing for the Rams, he was their team for a couple of years. But for the Falcons, it's Julio Jones and Matt Ryan. That's the team right there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And even when he was with the Rams, I mean, he was a significant part of their offense, but he wasn't the whole offense. So, you know, they had some their quarterback and some couple good wide receivers there too.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's pretty much who I have, I think, for significant running backs. I don't know if we want to get into our DBs here.
I have a personal one here I really like is Jason McCourty. I had the opportunity to see him play. You know, he was a Titan for several years. A very upstanding person, number one, but a very good player, number two. What I look at for defensive backs now is not so much interceptions, but how willing they are to go in and hit people. For 166 games that Pro Football Reference has him, he has a combined tackle of 723. Now that to me is amazing.
Absolutely.
I think he is with his brother now, or has been with his brother for the past couple of years for the Patriots. They, the twins, Devin and Jason, but
I've seen Jason play live, and I tell you what, I was glad he was on our team.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, both brothers are great defensive backs, but yeah, I think Jason might be the harder hitter from what I've observed. He definitely brings the wood, you know, to the pile. That's for sure. Yeah, but he's had 18 interceptions. That's not too shabby for his career. I think, was he like 10 years in the league now, I think?
Yes. Yes.
So that's nothing to, not too shabby at all. It's almost two interceptions a year. There's a lot of defensive backs that would love to have that.
We don't have, I don't think that there's a, and there might be a couple of shutdown corners, but most of them are get your head down, get into the play, and get out. Right. And Jason McCourty is one of those guys that he's not a shutdown corner or a safety, but he is more of a, I'm going to stop the play from getting far ahead of me. I'm going to stop the play there. And you need those players.
Absolutely. You definitely do. I mean, it's not, we talked about, we had the number 24 series when this is airing. It hasn't come on yet. It's actually coming out tomorrow. But Dana Augustin and I talked about, we had a defensive back, Darrell Rivas, that only had 29 interceptions, but there was various reasons why he had that, because he was such a dominating cover man that quarterbacks stayed away from him. You know, so that's why his numbers were down so far. They threw the other side of the field from Rivas. So that doesn't necessarily mean just because you don't have a lot of interceptions from a defensive back, you know, it's a lot of it scheme and how good of a cover guy you are, because sometimes quarterbacks just don't want to throw in that area.
You know, Dana's a good guy. I'm glad you had him on there. He's awesome.
Oh yeah. Why? Quite the memory on that guy. He's
like, oh, I just let him go. Now I do have one more I want to throw out. Jamal Williams.
Okay.
Jamal Williams. Now this guy right here, when I was looking him up, I want to say, let me pull him up again. I want to say that I have seen him play. If it's the one I'm thinking of, if only my phone would want to work.
Well, this,
but I have him listed with 13 sacks, 443 tackles, and he's a three-time Pro Bowler and a two-time All-Pro. So that tells you about how good he is.
There must be – is there two Jamal Williams on our number 30 list? Because the Jamal Williams I'm called up as was a running back for the Packers the last 4 years.
You know what? I might have just typed in Jamal Williams and picked the one – oh, well, this one was a defensive. Nope, I pulled up the wrong guy.
Okay, all right.
You know what, Jamal Williams, I'm all about you. You're a good player. But he's number 76. So when you get to 76, okay, there you go. What happens is start. When you go on Pro Football Reference, if you don't pay attention, they're going to pull up more than one Jamal Williams. And I pulled up the wrong one.
Hey, that's easy to do. That's easy to do.
Oh, hey, I'm. You're already ahead.
We already got one in the books for 76.
Absolutely. You're already ahead. I'll tell you what, I'm helping out today.
Absolutely. Well, I guess running back, it's worth mentioning. He won't be on our list, but Dan Reeves wore number 30. You know, we know Dan is a coach, coached your Broncos for a long time. But Dan was a running back with the Dallas Cowboys, had just under 2,000 yards rushing, 25 touchdowns. 65-72 were the number 30 with the Cowboys. Just drop a name in there, because maybe he will be a Hall of Fame coach someday. Who knows?
If you ever want to listen to a good story, listen to Dan Reeves talk about the Ice Bowl.
Ah, okay.
He's got that Southern drawl, and he's talking about the Ice Bowl and how cold it was. And I've listened to him talk about that. I want to say that he was involved with the game, like trying to catch passes, and he said it hurt.
It hurt. It did.
But Dan Reeves and Marty Schottenheimer are two guys that were so close so many times. Dan Reeves nearly won the Super Bowl several times with the Broncos and with the Falcons. And the funny thing is, Dan Reeves got beat by his former team in Super Bowl 33.
Well, wasn't Reeves the one that beat Schottenheimer and like three times in the AFC Championship game?
A little retribution. I was listening to that today too. you know, the drive, John Elway, the drive, and then the fumble. Ernest Byner got his, got a ring though. He did with the Ravens, but Dan Reeves and Marty Schottenheimer are great coaches. I don't mm-hmm. care what you see, you know, they lost super, they're great coaches, both of them. And, he might not have been a great player, but he is, to me, he's a Hall of Famer when it comes to coaching.
Yeah. And you know, Schottenheimer, you know, just had his untimely death, only a month or two ago, but you know, you hear all his former players come out and talk about and people that coached with him, whether they were assistants under him or, you know, served with him when he was an assistant in the league. And you never heard anybody say anything bad about it. It was all very complimentary of him. And it's, and I know Schottenheimer was a Browns coach, and here as Steelers fans, we're not real fond of, you know, Browns players and coaches, but Schottenheimer's one that I definitely always respected because he was just a really good coach. Like you said, he had success wherever he went.
And, I still want to know what he meant when he says, there's a gleam, folks, there's a gleam. I haven't figured that out yet.
I don't know if I heard that one.
Oh yeah. Go look that up. He goes up to his team, and I think he was the Chargers coach at the time. And he says that, and people are looking at him like, what are you talking about? But you know,
maybe you got too much of that California sunshine out there.
I've never been out there. One day I might figure that out myself.
Nice place. I've been out there, especially San Diego, LA area. Beautiful, beautiful. All right, we got some other DBs here to talk about, though.
Okay.
One is kind of interesting, caught my eye, was Benny Parrish. And Benny was a defensive back, 1959 to 1966, again with the Cleveland Browns. This is a little bit later Browns era. This would have been part of the Jim Brown era, the Browns. But he had 31 interceptions. Three of those he took to the house. You know, that's not a whole lot of stats on defensive backs back then, but those are pretty glaring numbers. You know, his first 4 years in the league, 5 interceptions, 6 interceptions, 7 interceptions, 2 interceptions. You know, not too bad.
92-yard interception return for a touchdown and 238 interception yards in one season, which is incredible.
Right. Yeah,
so you know what? He should be on consideration just because of the time he played in and how well he did for those 3 years that you mentioned.
Right, and compared to all of our other defensive backs that were number 30 that I put the stats on, the ones I found significant, he has by far the most interceptions of any of them.
Yes, he does. There's one that I do want to bring up. LaRon Landry, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him coming out of college. I want to say it was LSU. No, it wasn't LSU. But I do remember him coming out of college, and there was a lot of buzz about him. And I think his career didn't go out the way he thought it was. But I want to point out he did have 617 tackles.
Right.
And again, to me, if a guy can put his head down from a safety or cornerback position and do those things, he can make my team any day.
He had 8 sacks in his career, too, from a DB. That's not too bad.
Oh, now, you know, Dick LeBeau really brought that in to the cornerback, you know, the blitzing the cornerback or the safeties. And to me, when you add that together, it's awesome. Yeah, it was LSU. I was right. Yeah. It's just awesome to watch somebody like a Blaine Bishop or somebody I'm familiar with. Blaine Bishop was an incredibly good sack master for the Titans. He knew how to do the cornerback blitz. And LaRon Landry was one of those guys that could do that as well.
Yeah, definitely a good defender. And like you said, that's really what his skill set was doing those blitzes and, you know, tackling the catch. You know, some cornerbacks and safeties are made for that. Some are ball hawks and are, you know, their skill set is playing the ball, but LaRon was a, you know, sure tackler, and they used it sometimes to get some tackles for losses. So that's a good weapon to have.
He didn't play very long in the grand scheme of things. I think injuries really got him, but when he was on, that part of the field was pretty much done.
Right. Yeah.
I really do enjoy. I did enjoy watching him play, not so much against my Tide, but when he played in the NFL, I really enjoyed him.
Yeah, he's definitely a memorable player. I can remember him myself. Now, another defensive back that's worth mentioning, and is Chad Scott. Chad Scott played 7 years with the Steelers and 2 years with the Patriots. He wore 30 his whole career, had 21 interceptions, 400 yards returned, 4 touchdowns on there for his career. So, I don't think he'll make the list, but he's definitely significant enough to mention. I don't know if you had anything further on him or not.
No. There are several of these players that I have stats, but I don't have any recollection of them, and I wish I did.
Go ahead if you got one in mind.
I do. Dave Meggett.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when I was growing up, Dave Meggett was one of those characters. I played with him on Tecmo Bowl. I definitely know that much. But he is one of the guys that I remember watching play for the Giants. And the reason I watched that, because a lot of the games that after 2 o'clock, when you get the nationwide games, the Giants were the team in the 80s. They were one of the top teams, them and the 49ers. And I remember watching Dave Meggett play. I don't think he was not a big guy, 5'7", 190. So you think, well, how in the world did he make an NFL roster? If I remember correctly, he was one of the toughest guys on the field. And he's listed with a one-time Super Bowl champion. He did win it with the Giants. Overall, he was one of those guys that Bill Parcells knew if he needed him in a pinch, there he was. Dave Meggett would do what needed to be done. He was a very solid player, and he's one of those guys that wouldn't have been your every down back. He was just not big enough. But a third down back out of the backfield, even kick returning at times, Dave Meggett was very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, but we talked a little bit ago about Brian Mitchell with his skill set. I think Dave Meggett was very similar. I mean, punt returns, he had a 10-yard average on his punt returns. He had 3,708 yards returned for 349 returns. Kick returns, 252 of them for over 5,500 yards. And, had 7 touchdowns on punt returns and 1 in kickoff returns. So those are good numbers. And like you said, his offensive performance was great too. He eight touchdowns, 4.2 yard average rushing the ball, 11 touchdowns he caught with the 9 yards per catch. Those are some great numbers and a great guy to have in the backfield when you're getting a little bit of trouble when you're a quarterback. Just a little speed demon, almost. I mean, very similar, I think, to the way Mitchell played.
They're very similar built, very similar skills. Brian Mitchell might have been faster and a little bit more elusive. But if you were playing in the late 80s, early 90s, Dave Meggett wouldn't have been 2 or 3. He would have been, I would want Dave Meggett on my team.
Right. Yep, most definitely. That's a good name to mention. I'm glad you said him. He was definitely fun to watch. I have one more, another DB that's worth mentioning, and that's Mike Brown. I don't think we talked about him at all. Mike played for the Chicago Bears 9 years of his 10 and Kansas City 1 year, but played from 2000 to 2009. And he was an interesting defensive back too. Had 20 interceptions in 116 games. 4 of those he returned for touchdowns. Solid player for the Bears.
I'm trying to remember him playing. He would have been in the Super Bowl that they played in against the Colts. I guess everybody, any free safety or cornerback would have looked like they didn't exist with Peyton Manning throwing the ball against them.
Yeah, that's true.
I can't remember him play. I really am drawing a blank on that.
Yeah, I don't think he was the lockdown shutdown corner on that team, but he was a very serviceable cornerback and played real well for the Bears for many years.
Well, if you're playing free safety, you're there to pretty much take care of the middle of a field, and sometimes just don't go over the middle. It may show how good he was that they didn't want to go over the middle.
Right. Well, I think we're coming down. Do you have anybody else you want to mention before we start going to our deliberations?
There's a bunch of people on here, but I think we have pretty much hit the highlight reel, including a number 76.
You know, right.
We just that's a bonus for today, folks. That's a bonus. You didn't pay for that. There's a gleam. There's a gleam.
There's your gleam. That's what he was talking about.
That's what he's talking about.
Okay, well, just to review, we've put four people on our list already of the 10. We have Terrell Davis, Amon Green, Bill Willis, and Clark Hinkle as our first four of 10 that we want to choose here. Now, some people we said we want to come back and talk about, Bill Brown, Lawrence McCutcheon, Ollie Mattson, Alex Wojcicki, I'm sorry I mispronounced the name again, Bernie Parrish, Todd Gurley, Brian Mitchell, and I think that's about it. So how many is that? 1, 2, 3.
All right. Well, I can see us putting Brian Mitchell in.
Okay. We have seven names we said we were going to come back, and we need six of those. So Brian Mitchell, I agree.
If you start an NFL team now and you need a kick returner, Brian Mitchell in his prime would have been – you would go Devin Hester and then Dante Hall, and then you would go Brian Mitchell.
But don't disagree with that. Okay. I'm going to say, I think Mr. Gurley ought to be on there because I think he's one of the, looking at this list, I can't think of somebody that's better than him at the running back position that we don't already have on the list.
Oh, I agree. Let's put him in.
All right. So that's six players we have on. Need four more.
See, it's kind of hard for me. Again, we're talking about time. Ollie Mattson, to me, for his time, would be would be great. If you put him in our time, he would be one of the top running backs. So,
okay.
I would say Ollie Mattson.
All right. We'll put Ollie Mattson on. That's seven spots. And I think Lawrence McCutcheon probably ought to be on there too. With a 4.3 yard average.
Oh, yeah.
That was a pretty good average. So,
that was a very good average.
We'll put him in there. So we have two more. And we have Alex, we have Bill Brown, and Bernie Parrish left remaining. Bernie Parrish was our guy that had 31 interceptions. Alex was a center and a linebacker, had some interceptions himself from that spot. I'm thinking maybe Alex ought to be in there because that.
I think Alex should be in there.
Right. I think so too. So that gets all of our Hall of Famers on our list.
Absolutely.
And we have
they're in the Hall of Fame for a reason.
One more between Bill Brown, the running back that had 5,800 yards and 52 touchdowns, and Bernie Parrish, who had 31 interceptions in an era where they didn't pass that much. I think it's got to probably go to the DB with 31 interceptions.
I think I'm with you. We're going to sell Boom Boom jerseys, but Bernie Parrish should be our last player.
I totally agree. Okay, and in no particular order, our 10 choices are Brian Mitchell, Todd Gurley, Boom Boom Bernie Parrish, Alex, I'm not going to try to say his last name, I'll butcher it again, Clark Hinkle, Bill Willis, Ollie Mattson, Lawrence McCutcheon, Amon Green, and Terrell Davis. I think we did it.
I think we did it.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty satisfied with that. Now, before I let you go, and I greatly appreciate you joining us, what do you have coming up that we can look forward to on the Football's Family podcast?
Well, I have a list of 10 things that I'm planning on doing in the next 10 weeks. But the big thing is this coming Thursday, I'm doing my Why I Like the Titans. I'm just going to go ahead and write my love sonnet for them. If I was, William Shakespeare, this would be a sonnet. Then I'm going to talk about the 1999 Titans. Then I'm going to have a guest come on to talk about the 80s Browns. And I'm working on getting
getting some feelers out to some local high school and college coaches in this area. But I might also throw a change up in there. I'm going to reach out to the basketball coach, or a couple of them, I can get them both on, of the college I attended. We're going to have Footballer's Family, the basketball edition.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's that family part. But then I'm working with somebody here that we're going to start writing articles as soon as we can figure out what we want to do with it about the Super Bowl rings.
Yeah, that is definitely a great project that I'm glad you brought up and brought me into. I'm excited about that.
You know, when the one thing is, there's a line from Draft Day. Why is it that the most burly men in the world want to fight for a ring? Well, guess what? They're beautiful.
Yes, they are.
And speaking of which, I'm going to do a review on the book, on the movie Draft Day.
Okay.
So if you would like to join in, you know, your homework would be to watch the movie Draft Day.
That's a great movie.
It is a very good movie.
Really, really big twist at the end.
We're not going to give it away, but I'll tell you this, there will be spoilers in that podcast. So just be ready.
But there will be. You got to talk about the end if you're talking about the movie.
Absolutely.
It's the best part.
And I got a good question to throw out there is, how does Draft Day and the Superman franchise, what do they have in common?
Draft Day and the Superman franchise.
Just a spoiler. No spoiler. This is intense questioning right now. You're going to be a cliff. It's good cliffhanger till that comes out.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. I'll have to wait to listen to your podcast to find out, I guess, huh?
Well, I guess we should. I tell you what, Darren, I appreciate you letting me come on. It's always a pleasure, my friend.
Well, we greatly appreciate you spending your time with us and doing this research and talking about these great players who were number 30 and come up with these lists with us. And I think we have you on for some more down the road here. So, and if not, we got to get you signed on to some more, because enjoy having your company.
Hey, it's my pleasure, my friend. And y'all like and subscribe to this podcast. This is one of my favorite podcasts on. Every day you listen to it, you get something new and you get positive reinforcement in a world that is negative. You need the positive, and Darren will deliver.
Well, thank you. That's kind words. And make sure you check out that Football is Family podcast. Every Thursday you're on with that?
Lord willing, yes. Now, okay. I do want to hear something from you before I leave.
Okay.
Can you give us a tighten up?
Oh, I don't know if I can do that.
Oh, Darren, you're killing me.
I'd be selling out my Steelerdom. You know, they'd kick me out of Steeler Nation if I did that.
But anyway, thank you.
Thank you. What an honor it was to have Jeremy McFarland on once again to talk about the greatest number 30s in NFL history. He's been a couple of our other Football by Numbers series podcasts, and he's always an interesting talk there because he has a lot of football knowledge in his head. And if you see or hear anything that we may have missed, any players number 30 that we may have missed, or maybe you have a better suggestion for our top 10, please email us at pigskindispatch@gmail.com, and we'll make sure in a future episode to make any corrections that we see fit after doing some investigation from your numbers. So thanks for joining us, folks. We're glad you enjoyed it. Tune in tomorrow for your football history headlines, and next week we'll get back into our Football by Numbers with the number 31s. Joe Ziemba joins us, and Joe Zagorski, and more Joe Ziemba. Lots of Joes and letter Z's as a last name coming up on your Football by Numbers, and lots of football history. So till tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman. aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found a Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.